Iranian-American comedian Maz Jobrani today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Maz Jobrani's never shied away from turning his Iranian heritage into comedy. And his new movie, Jimmy Vestwood, American Hero, is no exception.
I call it the Persian Pink Panther meets Borat. Jimmy Vestwood, American Hero, is my attempt at having the first hero of Iranian descent in an American movie.
Plus, a female politician in France comes forward to recount instances of sexual harassment.
She said, even in our party, we can't tell the difference between someone who's seducing you and someone who's outright harassing you.
And if you could think of one word to describe Havana right now...
The word is cool. Havana is cool. There is no doubt Havana is cool.
Okay, cool it is. Those stories coming up today on The World. Glad you could be here on this Wednesday. We're going to start off today talking politics. Here in America, the presidential race is giving us plenty of reason to think about how men treat women, not least because of Donald Trump's notorious comments about Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly during the first Republican debate. She pressed him about his comments about women in a sit-down interview last night. But in France, the conversation has reached fever pitch because of sexual harassment allegations against a particular politician. Reporter Adeline Sia has been watching all of this unfold. Adele, fill us in a bit on what led to this uproar in France.
Yeah, well, I think we may be seeing some kind of turning point here in history of women's rights and maybe men and women's interaction at work as well. Last week, there was a damning investigation that revealed a number of allegations of sexual harassment against Denis Baupin. He was until then a member of the parliament in France and a former Green Party leader. So he was asked to resign immediately, but he's denying all the charges at this point.
Yeah, what kind of allegations? What is it said he's done?
Well, four women came out against him at first and more since. Some women like Sandrine Rousseau, she was one of the spokespersons for the Green Party, reported one incident she said occurred in 2011. For example, she said that Baupin had pushed her against a wall in a hallway, grabbed her breast and tried to kiss her. Others mentioned text messages of a sexual nature. In another one, Annie Lamère said Baupin had told her she would never attain to an important job in the party because she had refused to sleep with him. And then she said something interesting. She said, even though this is the Green Party, so here at least a supposedly progressive-minded party, pro-women, pro-feminist, She said, even in our party, we can't tell the difference between someone who's seducing you and someone who's outright harassing you.
How are other politicians reacting to all of this?
Many interesting testimonies. One woman, Cécile Duflot, a member of the French National Assembly, she's a former minister and former head of the Green Party, so she was one of Baupin's close colleagues. She went on national television, and I have to say, you know, I really admire her for that, because it took a lot of guts to do that the day after the accusations came out. And she admitted that she had known about Baupin's behavior, but that none of her colleagues had wanted to testify, to speak out. You know, they were too scared. So she said it was really extremely complicated for women in politics, who are supposed to, you know, project power and confidence. It was really difficult for them to speak out against harassment, and this is what she had to say.
Vous voyez bien que dans cet univers, quand vous êtes une femme, si vous êtes dans un statut de victime ou qui passe pour une pisse froide, qui comprend pas, qui est coincée, qui une féministe qui donne des leçons.
So she said you can clearly see that in that world, if you put yourself in a victim situation or risk passing as a sourpuss who doesn't get it, who is stuck up, who is a lecturing feminist, that is a handicap. And that is what happens to women who try to speak out. In this world where we have to project self-confidence, if you recognize publicly that you're a victim, you look weak. So that's why women are right to speak up now, and that's why the issue needs to be considered collectively, to send shame back to the other side, because that's the reality. So she admitted she'd made mistakes, but she also said that she had herself been the victim of sexual harassment in her career, not from Baupin, but she also said that one in five women in France is harassed at work. And many who speak out end up losing their job.
So you lived in the U.S. for many years, Adele. How does the situation in France compare with here?
I have to say it's really a very different landscape. I've been back in France only for about a year now, so it's not always easy to compare. But from my experience at work in the U.S., I can say that there are probably much clearer boundaries about this in the U.S. in general. And you know, this has been out and discussed more in the U.S. than in France at this point.
Right. I mean, everything that you said so far kind of indicates that there's been a culture of silence around sexual harassment in France. Do you think that's changing? Could this be the change?
To me, it feels like growing pains, you know, for the culture. There's much to be learned and there's much to be discovered from many, many women's testimonies. And hopefully, instead of casting doubt on them, we'll just receive their testimonies and realize that there's much work to be done.
Reporter Adeline Sia speaking with us from Burgundy in France. In addition to the Baupin sexual harassment scandal, there's unrest of a different kind taking place in France, labor unrest. It's been going on for a couple of months, with angry protesters opposed to a new labor law clashing with police. Just this week, striking workers shut down trains and ferries. Time correspondent Vivian Walt lives in Paris and has been feeling the effects of the unrest directly.
This has been going on for months now. You know, demonstrations and clashes with police on the streets have become almost a daily event in Paris. You know, if you're, for example, just one neighborhood away from where it's happening, you wouldn't really know it's happening. Yesterday, for example, you really did know it was happening because the helicopters were in the air. And there were really hours in which there was all-out battle on the streets.
And then you get an email from your kid's school principal.
You know, just a kind of a regular email of the day arrived yesterday afternoon just to inform you that we have, you know, ended recess because the schoolyard is full of tear gas. So when I asked my kid about this, actually, when he came home from school, he looked at me as if I was kind of dumb and said, you know, well, everybody knows that in France, you know, there's demos and there's tear gas. So this has just become really a kind of ongoing way of life.
And this isn't just Paris, is it? How widespread is the unrest?
Well, it's in many different cities. And that's largely because the government rammed through this labor law using a very rarely enacted measure on the floor of parliament, which is really used for kind of national emergencies. But effectively, the prime minister said, enough of this, we're passing this law.
So tell us about that law, because you call this a labor battle. What is the law about? What's behind all this unrest?
Well, it might be familiar for people who have been watching French politics for a while, because it really is a kind of recast of proposals that have been going on for many, many years in France. And it essentially revolves around loosening the way people are hired and fired in France. Essentially, what happens at the moment is that French workers have effective lifetime tenure after a certain period, and that period is rather short. So either you're on a very temporary contract or you're on a contract which is almost impossible to get rid of somebody under.
And these protests, Vivian, have been kind of violent. What does that suggest?
Well, the youth, certainly, if we can just start with them, the folks that are actually entering this labor market have almost no confidence in the government doing anything on their behalf and for the benefit of their futures. There's such a deep, deep disillusionment.
Finally, Vivian, I've been hearing talk of organized gangs of hooded youth called casseurs or breakers. Who are these guys?
There is a kind of hardcore cadre, if you like, of the black hooded, what they call the black bloc in France, who proclaim themselves to be anarchists and who show up to a lot of street demonstrations, and they are there to confront the police. And if you watch enough of these demonstrations, you see a pattern emerging over and over again of there being a kind of real social movement, people walking in the streets, delivering a message to the government or the police, and then along come the kind of frontline troops, if you like, that don't have much to do with this protest, and the rocks begin to fly and the tear gas begins to fly.
Do they have any political edge, or are they true anarchists just out to provoke?
They never really deliver a coherent political message other than calling themselves anarchists. They're obviously virulently against the police. and against, you know, the authority of the government in trying to impose order on the social movement on the streets. But other than that, they're not aligned with any party. They don't really have a leader. They are a kind of wave, if you like, of impassioned youth who are prepared to go the next step.
Vivian Walt, Time Magazine's Paris correspondent. Thank you very much, Vivian.
You're welcome.
Now a story about French politics and American politics, too. As candidates everywhere all know, there are many ways to get your message in front of voters. TV and radio ads, mailers and flyers, mass emails, and don't forget asking for votes door to door. You'd think politicians use the same methods everywhere, but that is not always the case. The World's Jason Margolis spoke with one researcher who studied this in France.
When François Hollande was running for president of France in 2012, his campaign wanted to try something completely different. For decades, French politicians had relied on mass communication to reach voters. That's how most modern campaigns work in the United States. But not always. The Hollande campaign took note of Barack Obama's on-the-ground mobilization efforts in 2008. Vincent Pons was one of Hollande's campaign directors. Pons helped mobilize 80,000 volunteers, the largest door-to-door campaign in Europe to date.
We knocked on 5 million doors.
That's a lot of 3 to 5 minute conversations with strangers. Pons says the doors weren't chosen at random, though.
They were chosen to target a specific type of voters that we wanted to reach out to, which were left-wing non-voters or undecided voters that we knew were hesitating between voting for the left or for the right.
Hollande's staff pored over data at the precinct level to analyze voting patterns. Pons is now an assistant professor at the Harvard Business School and studies politics. He says they decided to pound the pavement for Hollande because they concluded it was more efficient than just sending out cheap mass mailings to voters.
With door-to-door canvassing, on average, you win one vote for each 14 doors. And I think it's easy to understand. You know, door-to-door canvassing involves a personal and direct interaction with someone, a mailer. Oftentimes, people will not even look at it.
But here's the question. Is going door-to-door more cost-effective? It's expensive to train political activists. And if you can't get volunteers, you have to pay people. Researchers like Pons are interested in one thing.
You know, the metric is how many votes you win for $1.
Or think of it this way. How many dollars does it cost to get one vote? Researchers at Columbia and Yale found that it costs $31 to produce a vote going door-to-door, even paying people to do it. That's more than 3 times cheaper than sending out direct mailers. Given all this, here's the big, big question. Can knocking on enough doors actually win an election? If it's close, yeah.
This can help you win a few percentage points, perhaps, but obviously it's not going to increase your vote share by 10 percentage points.
So if a candidate is way behind, it doesn't matter how many doors they knock on. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Havana is the place to be, it seems. Everyone from President Obama to the Kardashians has been there recently. One side effect of the U.S. normalizing relations with Cuba. But we haven't heard that much about how this is impacting people on the island. My BBC colleague Will Grant has been in Havana since long before the thaw, so he's been keeping an eye on the changes and how Cubans feel about them. He sent this report from the Cuban capital.
Havana has long been considered chic, but it's never hosted anything quite like this. El Prado, a leafy boulevard in the crumbling old town, was recently converted into an open-air catwalk by the French fashion house Chanel. Some of the world's top models shimmied down the tree-lined avenue to unveil the 2017 cruise collection by leading designer Karl Lagerfeld. Among the VIPs in the audience were Hollywood actors Vin Diesel and Tilda Swinton.
It's a wonderful once-in-a-lifetime invitation to come to Cuba, which is a place like many of us that I've been wanting to come to for years, and I've never managed it. I never expected to come here with Chanel, but yeah, Chanel brought me here. I'm very grateful.
But not everyone was enamored of the experience. Local residents like Adaibis Rodriguez, who lives in a decrepit building on Prado itself, said many neighbors were kept away from the event by scores of police and state security. Others strained for a glimpse from their balconies, fostering the sense that ordinary Cubans were mere extras in Lagerfeld's set of decaying grandeur. Of course, it's not just Chanel in town recently. The Rolling Stones played on the island just days after the historic visit by President Obama. Hollywood has been here too, as Showtime filmed their hit series House of Lies and Universal Studios, the eighth instalment of their Fast and Furious franchise on the iconic streets of the capital. Scores of celebrities have made private visits to the communist island too, from Paris Hilton to the Kardashians.
Havana is cool at the moment. The world is cool. Havana is cool. There is no doubt Havana is cool.
Rosa Bosch is a Spanish film producer who has lived in Cuba since the 1980s and worked on the music documentary Buena Vista Social Club. She says that Cuba has always attracted top artists and directors, including during the revolution.
A lot of the visitors would be seen as coming under the Solidarity umbrella. Harry Belafonte, who used to be a regular visitor for many years, Sidney Pollack was the biggest director in the land. They were coming in and out. The Cubans have never had a problem with welcoming Coppola, Sidney Pollack, whoever comes. The problem was always on the American side. For instance, the Screen Actors Guild would not allow member actors to have earnings in Cuba. So the blockade worked in very funny ways.
Now I officially welcome you on behalf of the University of Arts.
To try to address those challenges, the White House sent an arts and culture delegation, including R&B artist Usher and soul legend Smokey Robinson, to Cuba. During their visit, they toured the renowned Higher Institute of Arts, or ISA, in Havana to meet the students and identify areas they could work together. Among the group was American actor Cal Penn from the hit show House and the Harold and Kumar comedy films.
Most of the films I do are pretty lowbrow, broad comedies, and I love them for that reason. It's always interesting to see when you go to different parts of the world, people who kind of point and laugh at you because they're remembering some absurd scene from your movie. I had no idea whether that was going to happen in Havana or not, and it has been happening, and it's a very humbling feeling, honestly, to know that laughter everywhere is the same, and we have the opportunity to make each other smile and laugh.
Another apparent first in Havana, a joint US-Cuba music festival called Musica Havana. The crowd was an interesting mix of visiting foreigners and ordinary Cubans, certainly more so than at the Chanel event. It's hard to know whether future arts, cinema, fashion and music projects in Cuba will be genuinely collaborative or the exclusive reserve of the elites. But Spanish film producer Rosa Bosch remains optimistic.
I'm going to believe and make a bet that what is going on is very promising in terms of significant things, that there is beyond the Facebook cool. Because I think at the same time that you have the Paris Hilton, you also have people with great heads and great insight analysing and trying to do work here. Those people, we don't see them on Facebook.
And perhaps that's cooler anyway, right?
And perhaps that is cool too, yeah.
My BBC colleague Will Ross there in Havana. Staying in Latin America, if you were following the news back in the 1980s and 90s, you might remember the name Tupac Amaru, as in Peru's Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, which was considered a terrorist organization by the U.S. What you might never have learned, though, was the origin of the group's name. It was taken from an 18th century Peruvian rebel known as Tupac Amaru, and it was 235 years ago today, in 1781, that he was put to death by Spanish colonial authorities. Tupac Amaru, in turn, took his name from another Tupac Amaru. That Tupac was the last king of the Incas and was also executed by the Spanish in the 1500s. The second Tupac Amaru claimed to be a descendant of that last king. In the 1700s, he called for the freedom of indigenous peoples and an end to Spanish colonial rule. He eventually became a revolutionary leader, but his rebellion failed and he was captured and executed. Last night, there was a candlelight vigil to honor the second Tupac Amaru's memory. It was held in the same square in the colonial city of Cusco, where Amaru was put to death. Several local mayors were there, among them Antonio Araoz Enriquez.
Tupac Amaru es el primer hombre revolucionario que habla de la libertad Tupac Amaru was also the first to speak up for the freedom of African slaves and for an end to the exploitation of all those enslaved for the sake of Spanish domination. He spoke about freedom and about Peru's independence. He said we could not go on under Spain's thumb, but not just here in Peru. He spoke about the need for freedom across Latin America, in countries like Ecuador, Chile, Bolivia, and Colombia. He spoke up for freedom everywhere.
The vigil in Cusco had another goal, to demand more respect for Tupac Amaru from Peru's current authorities. His rebellion against Spanish rule happened decades before the one led by Simón Bolívar, a white Creole. Bolívar became known as the liberator of Latin America, but Arauz Enriquez says indigenous leaders like Amaru are given short shrift today. For example, he says the house where Amaru was born and raised has been allowed to deteriorate to the point that it's starting to fall apart.
Así como la casa de Simón Bolívar en Venezuela es uno de los museos más importantes de...
Just like Simón Bolívar's house is one of the most important museums in Venezuela, the same should happen with Tupac Amaru's house here, because it is arguably much more important for our history here in Latin America. It should be a tourist destination, among other things.
Entre otros que debería ser.
Arauz Enriquez and other mayors in the Cusco region want the Peruvian government to preserve Amaru's house. He says they recently gained some support in the Peruvian Congress. But the project will probably have to wait at least until after next month's presidential election runoff. By the way, it's no accident that that name, Tupac, has a contemporary resonance here in the U.S. It was adopted by the late rapper Tupac Shakur in homage to the Peruvian revolutionary who died 235 years ago today. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Deborah Smith translated a Korean novel. Now it's won a major literary award. And get this, Smith only learned Korean 6 years ago.
The skill of a literary translation is how well you know the target language, not really how well you know the source language.
That story plus a conversation with comedian Maj Jobrani, still ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Mistakes in wartime are costly, and as we saw last October at a hospital in the city of Kunduz, Afghanistan, they can also be horrifying and tragic. In the middle of the night, when most of the staff and patients were asleep, an American military plane circled above the building and began attacking. 42 people were killed, many more were injured. It turned out that U.S. Special Forces had been searching for a different target, but the plane attacked the hospital instead. Matthew Akins has investigated what happened in Kunduz for the New York Times.
The AC-130 gunship has been called in to support the U.S. Special Forces and also these Afghan commandos who are that night launching a raid on a Taliban headquarters. So the gunship sort of circles low and slow above the city, and this is what's called in to do an airstrike on a compound that turns out, of course, to be a fully functioning Doctors Without Borders hospital.
So they're looking on the ground and seeing two buildings that might be their target. What happened?
Well, what happened was that the special forces themselves couldn't see the target. They were sort of inside this police compound that they'd set up as a forward headquarters. So they were talking on the phone with the Afghan commandos who were going to raid the NDS headquarters, the headquarters of the Afghan Intelligence Service in Kunduz. And so they couldn't see the target. The AC-130, its systems weren't working properly, so it couldn't exactly, you know, use the grid coordinates that were given. So it was looking at a couple different buildings. And so what happened, and what really is kind of a central part of this piece, is that they relied on a description that had been given to them by the Afghan commandos. And the description describes the MSF hospital, not the NDS headquarters.
So when you say Afghan commandos, you mean commandos in the Afghan National Army, correct?
That's correct. They're known as the KKA, and they're sort of the top force in the Afghan army.
Because you've also found that somewhat downplayed up to this point has been the Afghan army's involvement in all of this. What was their connection to the attack on the MSF hospital in Kunduz?
Yeah, I mean, it's not really present in the military's official report and narrative of the events, but the commandos were the ones who described the hospital, gave a description of the hospital to the special forces, or a description that matched the hospital to the special forces, and that resulted, you know, was a key element in the AC-130 deciding to strike the hospital. And, you know, I spoke to a lot of these commandos and other forces, Afghan forces in Kunduz, when I visited there in November as part of the story. And a lot of them were still convinced that the Taliban had actually taken over the MSF hospital. There was kind of a longstanding animosity between MSF and the Afghan forces, because the Afghan forces, many of them at least, don't accept the fact that the hospital treats, you know, anybody, including wounded Taliban fighters.
Matthew, how much do we know about the Taliban taking over the MSF hospital? Like, how many Taliban fighters were there?
The Taliban did not take over the MSF hospital. I mean, I spoke to, this is MSF contention, this is anyone who's looked at it. I've spoken to people who are staff, patients, civilians, even spoke to the Taliban. There is zero evidence that the Taliban had taken over the hospital. That is a false contention that the Afghans reported to the U.S. And, you know, as we put out in the piece, I think it may have had to do something. It may have been one of the reason behind the strike. They may have intentionally misled the U.S. into committing, you know, this incredible tragedy.
Finally, Matthew, your investigation for The Times reminds us of the horror that just went on for nearly an hour that the people who worked in the hospital went through. What have the ones who made it out alive been telling you?
Well, they're just stunned that this could have happened. You know, this hospital is the safest place for us. And it was just horrifying how this place that was so important to the people of Kunduz, it provided them with free medical care that was full of, you know, women and children and patients and doctors and nurses, could be destroyed, you know, utterly razed in the space of less than an hour.
So the ones who survived, how are they moving on, especially after what they have lived through now?
Well, one of the problems is that they've been waiting for compensation from the U.S. military, and the military has only given condolence payments. They won't call it compensation, of $6,000 per person who was killed. And, you know, a lot of these victims or their relatives think that a life is worth more than that, but that's all they've gotten from the government. MSF is still waiting to feel safe again and to decide if they want to rebuild the hospital. So even though it's 7 months after the attack, there's still a kind of state of suspended limbo that these people are in.
What are the options for hospitals right now in Kunduz?
There is a government hospital that provides a much lower standard of medical care. And in fact, people are traveling all the way to Kabul, you know, which is a 12-hour drive to the south over bad roads. When I was just in Kabul at the emergency hospital there, which is another NGO, medical NGO, and they were saying they were seeing people come in with terrible infections who had taken, you know, several days to get to them because there was nothing now in northern Afghanistan.
Matthew Akins investigated the attack on the MSF hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, for The New York Times. Matthew, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
When you're in a new school, the last thing you want is to feel different. But adjusting to a new school is really tough if you're a student who's just arrived from another country. And there's a trend now in some parts of the U.S. where schools create a separate space for immigrant students, kind of a high school within a high school. There are about two dozen such setups in the U.S. right now. One of the newest is in Prince George's County, Maryland. We sent reporter Shuka Kalantari to check it out.
It's 8:30 a.m. and Khatoum is walking to the bus in Lana, Maryland. She puts on her headphones. Senegalese dance music. Khatoum moved here from Senegal 2 years ago with her family. Now she's one of 100 ninth graders at International High School at Largo. It's a new English language immersion school created for kids like her, new immigrants in Maryland. Khatoum's school is actually within a much bigger traditional high school that's over 90% African American. But their classes and sports clubs are separate. Their lunches are separate. Khatoum likes it that way.
We don't get bullied or they don't laugh at the way you speak.
Khatoum says students from the main school stare at her when she's in the halls. Like, she's different. It makes her uncomfortable.
It just makes me feel like they didn't want to see you.
Suzumel is Khatoum's friend. She's 14 and from Haiti, and also feels more comfortable being separated from the U.S.-born students.
So having the two schools mixed together wouldn't be a good thing for us.
Bob Ross disagrees. He heads the county's NAACP chapter and says keeping the schools apart is segregation. It goes against Brown versus Board of Education.
But somebody still have to speak up for the African-American community. And so I do that, and I don't apologize for it.
Ross says kids, whatever their immigration status, should learn together. And immigrants should learn about their African-American neighbors.
Because I don't think people really understand the African-American community. New people that come to the country really don't understand the African-American community.
Research backs them up, showing students in racially diverse schools are more likely to thrive and have interracial friendships. Ross says integrate the two schools.
Anything can work if you put the right framework into it. It just takes time.
We're two separate schools in one building, and that partnership's actually working really well.
Allison Hinks Sloan is the principal of the International High School. She says new immigrants need a separate space. Today, one-third of English language learners drop out of high school.
That's true in Maryland. That's true in the United States.
She says her school tries to battle dropout rates with intensive ESL programs and steady counseling. Take the case of David Ortega, a freshman at the school. He's from El Salvador and almost dropped out this week. David migrated to Maryland alone last year, but the pressure he feels from his parents back home to drop out of school and start working is constant. They called him this morning.
They are like, hey, son, how are you? I'm okay, and you? I'm okay, but I need money. I say, why? Because I need to buy something like clothes for your sister. So I am like, I'm studying. Sorry, I am in high school. I'm not working.
David's parents didn't like that answer.
They are like, you are in the United States. You need to work. They say that. So that's the big problem in my life.
Cassandra Ballinger, the international school's social worker, gave David support.
What he said to me is, can you please convince me to not drop out of high school? I need for you to help me understand why I need to stay, because nobody else in my family has a high school diploma.
Ballinger gave David a chart showing how he'd make more money with a high school degree.
He sees the possibilities. He basically wants a little piece of the American dream.
David says the conversation convinced him to stay in school.
I like to study because that way I can to have the opportunity to be somebody. My most goal is have a good job. That's my goal.
David Ortega says he likes his small international high school, but he also wouldn't mind if the two schools mixed, so long as he keeps getting that extra support. Without it, he might not be in school today. For The World, Shuka Kountari, Prince George's County, Maryland.
The Man Booker International Prize for Fiction came out this week, and South Korean writer Han Kang got the brass ring for her novel The Vegetarian. It's about a woman who believes she is turning into a tree. Critics have called the story lyrical and lacerating. It's also pretty erotic. But the thing many people are talking about isn't necessarily the book itself. It's the translator, Deborah Smith, 28 years old, and she only started learning Korean 6 years ago. Deborah Smith joins me from our studios at our BBC partners in London. Deborah, I got to ask you, you understood zero Korean, and now 6 years later, you are the English translator of a Korean novel that wins the Man Booker Prize. How'd you do it?
If you're asking for the secret, then I'm afraid I'm as ignorant as you are.
I was actually asking for the secret.
Yeah, actually, it was in 2013 that I translated the book, because publishing has a pretty big lag time and even longer if you factor in translation. So that was only 3 years after I'd first started teaching myself Korean. And looking back now, it feels like I must have looked up almost every other word in the dictionary. That's probably an exaggeration, but that's definitely what it felt like at the time. It was a bit like climbing a mountain.
It must have been challenging. I mean, or maybe looking up every word in the dictionary was some kind of proper method.
Well, I definitely think that, you know, not being a native Korean speaker and not having learned it for very long, I really knew that I needed to double check everything and to be extra careful, and also to, you know, question the sort of dictionary translations of certain terms. You know, okay, this is the literal equivalent, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's the right word to use if you're aiming for some kind of literary effect. So I think that sort of rigor definitely helped me.
Yeah, how did you do that? I mean, you weren't living in Korea, were you, when you were translating this?
No, I wasn't. I was living in London pretty much all of the time, although I have visited Korea maybe 6 or 7 times now. Mm-hmm. And my Korean always gets a little bit better when I'm there, but I'm never sort of there for long enough for it to really get good.
Did you have like a little brain trust of Koreans that you could turn to and say, hey, does this really mean that?
I had one Korean friend who I, yes, imposed myself upon to ask her many annoying questions about what certain things meant. I was studying for a PhD at the time, and she was studying with me. And she was usually happy to help out, although she did then get me to proofread all of her coursework as well.
Wow. What have you heard from Koreans in the UK who've read your translation? I mean, can they tell you were not a native speaker until a few years ago?
No, I don't think so. I mean, nobody's really commented on that from having read it. People certainly talk about it from, you know, hearing my story through other channels. But the strength of the translation and the skill of a literary translation is how well you know the target language, not really how well you know the source language. Mm. If you don't know a certain word, dictionaries exist, the internet exists, native speaker friends exist. But if you don't know how to use English, and if you don't know how to recreate a certain style or a tone or a voice, which you learn from reading, which I've been, in that case, I'm overqualified. I read, you know, a couple of hundred books a year, and I have done for as long as I can remember. So I think on that end, I was pretty confident.
Do you think that if it weren't for you, Han Kang wouldn't have won the Man Booker Prize?
That's a very difficult question to answer.
It sounds like the answer is yes. And if you're being modest, you might as well just let that one go.
It's just, I don't know. It didn't happen that way. It's not as though I'm the only Korean to English translator in the world. That's absolutely not the case. But obviously, it's a fantastic book in its own right. And the Korean version is stunning, which is what I thought when I first read it.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you finally why you like the book. What was it about The Vegetarian that made you feel so strongly that it needed translation and you would do it?
I think it's one of those books where you can really see what is exciting about contemporary Korean literature, which is that it is quite distinctive from a lot of other countries. And this book in particular was originally written as three separate novellas and then combined into what's called a linked novel, which was something I'd never come across in anything else I'd read. And I thought that was kind of the point of translation, to make something available in a language or a culture that is new and that wasn't there before.
Deborah Smith, the translator of the novel The Vegetarian by South Korean novelist Han Kang. The novel won the Man Booker International Prize for Fiction this week. Deborah, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Iranian-American comedian Maz Jobrani has a new movie out, a comedy, no surprise, called Jimmy Vestwood, American Hero. That's American with a K.
Jimmy Vestwood, like Clint Eastwood, but Vestwood.
The reason I want to hire you, Jim Bell, is because I think that my wife is having an affair with an Arab. And what better way to catch an Arab than with another Arab?
Very good point. But, sir, I'm actually from Iran.
Jobrani has made a career out of cultural stereotypes, the kind he's experienced as an Iranian immigrant to the U.S. In his new film, he's turned them on their head, making his character, the seemingly hapless Iranian immigrant Jimmy Vestwood, the hero of the film. Maz, you deal with stereotypes that Americans have of Middle Easterners, of Iranians, of Arabs. What about stereotypes that people from the Middle East have of each other that we don't know about? Like, does that happen? I mean, it must.
It's interesting you say that because I wrote a book called I'm Not a Terrorist, but I've Played One on TV. And right. On the cover of it, well, that was referring to early in my career. I had a couple of roles like that. And on the cover, I put on a Palestinian keffiyeh, and I'm holding kind of a Wile E. Coyote bomb, and I've got this expression of confusion on my face. Like, how did I end up here? And really, I was making fun of how Hollywood mixes us up all together. And I put it on the cover of my Facebook page before the book came out. I said, here's my book. It's coming out. And it's so interesting. I've said this. There's racism within the groups. And it's kind of very disheartening because before the book even came out, an Iranian lady wrote me on Facebook, why are you wearing Arab headgear on the cover of your book? We are not Arab. We are Persian. And I said, calm down, lady. I know that. I'm trying to make fun of how Hollywood mixes
That's
up together.
The point.
Yeah. And then she goes back. She goes, but we are not even terrorists. And I go, well, the book clearly states I am not a terrorist, but I've played one on TV. And this discussion went back and forth for a while. And finally, I, like, you know, shut her up. And then an Arab guy wrote me, why are you wearing Arab headgear? You're not Arab, you're Persian. So I wrote him back. I said, listen, there's this Persian lady I want you to meet. You guys be perfect for each other because you're both literally judging a book by its cover, you idiots.
So, I mean, that's interesting, speaking of stereotypes, because your movie, Jimmy Vestwood, it kind of feels like you are capitalizing on stereotypes.
Yeah,
is that right?
Well, yeah, Jimmy Vestwood is making fun of some of the stereotypes. Jimmy Vestwood, American Hero, is my attempt at having the first hero of Iranian descent in an American movie. And that's the point of it. It's a silly comedy. I call it the Persian Pink Panther meets Borat. And
what's the plot?
The plot is it's an Iranian who wins the green card lottery to come to America, and he wants to be a cop because he was a big fan of Steve McQueen's from back in the day, and he wants to be like McQueen in the movie Bullet. But once he gets to L.A., the only job he can find is working as a security guard at a Persian grocery store. And then from there, somehow he finds himself embroiled in a plot to start World War III, and he's got to save the world. Yeah, and the tagline is, heroes are not born, they're imported.
So it's still stereotyping, though, isn't it?
Well, it's making fun of the stereotype, because what it is I think that as an Iranian-American actor, I've noticed that a lot of the parts that are out there are terrorist parts and the villain parts. So this is turning that on its head and having a hero rather than a villain who happens to be of Middle Eastern descent.
I don't know if you saw this hashtag, starring John Cho.
Yeah, I heard about that, yeah.
It's basically this digital strategist who's taking John Cho, the actor, and putting him on movie posters and imagining him in these starring roles, an Asian American. I'm wondering if it were like hashtag starring Maz Jobrani, if you could be cast as any character, who would you like to play?
Well, that's what this is. In this movie, as a matter of fact, when Jimmy Vestwood meets this this blonde bombshell played by Deanna Russo, he tells her, he says, my name is Vestwood, Jimmy Vestwood, like Clint Eastwood, but Vestwood. So yeah, I'll play Dirty Harry. I'll do it.
What about Bond? Because John Cho really comes across as a pretty cool Bond.
I would love to play Bond. I've always said that growing up as an Iranian America, I've always felt deprived because a lot of my British friends had James Bond. So it was like Bond, James Bond. As a kid, we had Ayatollah Khomeini. So it was Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini. Not as catchy.
No, it's not. I got to travel to Iran. I was telling you this before we started recording for the first time in February. And at the check-in counter in Istanbul, it was pretty amazing just seeing the faces of Iranians going back home. It's this melting pot of skin colors and eye colors and hair colors. And I know you've made the point in your comedy bits that Persians are Aryan, not Arab. I'm just wondering, does that get exhausting, making the distinction between Arabs and Aryans for Americans, or is this just for a comedian the gift that keeps on giving?
You know, I did it a few times, and I've gotten to the point now, even the words Iranian versus Persian, I used to distinguish it a lot more, but now I'm kind of at this point of like, you know what, as long as people are paying a little bit of attention, because listen, let's face it, for the longest time, the press we were getting was Ahmadinejad. So that's kind of gone out the door, which is nice. Now we've got the nuclear deal. I mean, it seems like things are looking up. You know what I'm saying? The sanctions are being lifted. Maybe more pistachios coming into the country. You know, Persian rugs.
Great pistachios, by the way.
Great pistachios. You know what I'm saying? So I've stopped worrying about those little details. I mean, from time to time, though, I will have to correct people. Sometimes I'll do like a morning radio show somewhere and they'll say, so what's it like being an Arab? And I'm like, well, nothing against Arabs, but I'm actually Iranian. But it's all right. Let's keep moving. You know, Middle Eastern, it's all good.
Yeah, you give it one more spin in the movie, too.
In the movie, too, yeah. The villain played by John Hurd, he is hiring Jimmy Vestwood to follow an Arab because he says, you Arabs know, you know, how you think. And I go, well, I like that that you're giving me the job, but I'm not Arab. I'm Iranian. I put it in the movie. You're right.
So I can't let you go without asking you about the presidential election. Is 2016 also the gift that keeps on giving?
Oh, my God. It does keep. I tried to not do material about it for the longest time, Marco.
Why?
Because it was so obvious and there were so many people talking about it. Until this happened to me, I went to visit my mom, Iranian lady, and a lot of Trump supporters were saying, I love him because he says what's on his mind. He just says what's on his mind. And I thought it was ridiculous to like, go to my mom's condo and she goes, Maz, I like this guy because he says what's on his mind. And I was like, oh, no, she fell for it. And I go, Mom, are you crazy? He's anti-immigrant. If he became president, your relatives couldn't come to visit you. She goes, I don't like them anyway. So it was interesting to hear my mom being a Trump supporter for a minute, but I talked her back down. I do say when he first started running, everybody thought it was a joke. So everyone you talked to was like, ha, 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 ha. Now everyone's like, ha, 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 ha. Like nobody believes that it's happening, but it's happening.
Moving forward, do you see yourself being always a kind of Iranian American immigrant comedian, or is like at some point your goal to go mainstream?
Well, my goal has always been to go mainstream. I consider myself a comedian that happens to be Iranian American. And if people come to my stand up shows, they'll see I do a lot of material about my kids now, about other issues. It's not just all ethnic stuff. The movie is a little different because, like I said, it was a goal to have a hero of Middle Eastern descent. It was also my homage to the Peter Sellers Pink Panther movies. Mm. And what's been amazing, Marco, is this, that we just came out last week in Los Angeles and D.C., and people came out. I really feel that the Iranian community, and I think Middle Easterners, are sick of being depicted the way they are in film and television. So we ended up with the fourth best per screen average in the country, right behind Captain America.
Mm-hmm.
So
wow.
People are coming out, and it's amazing to see it. So as much as I want to go mainstream, I do know that the ethnic community is behind us as well, behind me as well. So it's good to have that support.
All right. Maz Jobrani, thank you very much. That was great, man.
Thank you, Marco.
Actor and comedian Maz Jobrani, his new film is called Jimmy Vestwood, American Hero. We also have a video of Maz featuring his thoughts about a possible Trump presidency. That's up on our Facebook page. Just head over to Facebook and look for PRI's The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.